Welcome to Syntax. We got a good one for you today. We have Corbin Crutchley on, who's the author of The Framework Field Guide. It's a guy, Framework Field Guide. This is a book he just put out. You can grab it online. It's comparing Vue, Angular, and React. And A, something we've had a lot of questions on is why don't you do more Angular and Vue content? And B, it's not often you talk to somebody who like knows in depth all three things or multiple frameworks and can sort of talk about them on there. So we have Corbin on to talk about that, as well as like I'm kind of curious to talk about like what the process of writing a book like this is and all the stack used and everything. So welcome, Corbin. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
Where are you from? I know you're on vacation right now or something like that.
Yeah. So I'm in LA at the moment, but typically I'm in Sacramento. So it's funny. I just got back from ngConf. So I drove to Salt Lake City, Utah, drove back to Sacramento to stop at my house, and then drove all the way to LA. So a lot of driving recently.
Oh, man.
Yeah. It's good that you were at that conf, because I had some questions about some of the news from that conf. So
So what's your background then? Are you an Angular developer? Are you a full stack guy?
So I started as a full stack Angular developer alongside Mongo and Express and, you know, the typical mean stack back in my career, like at the very start of NG2, like the RC and beta releases. My company was like very certain that that was going to be the future, and they were totally right. So we started there in my career, stayed there for about 3.5, almost 4 years. And then I joined Hilton as a React developer. And I've mostly been into React since then, but I've done a lot of side projects in Vue as well. In fact, I wrote my own Vue renderer along with my buddy James Fenn. So just a lot of fun experimentation across all the three frameworks. And at one point I was like, you know, there's a lot of similarities when I was learning one versus the other. So I figured, why not throw them together in a single resource?
Nice. And before we get too crazy on this, if you're experimenting with any of these frameworks, you're probably going to want some kind of error and exception handling tracking, because you're going to make some bugs. We all do. So head on over to sentry.io/syntax. Sign up and get 2 months for free. You can track all of your bugs. Make sure that you're not running into anything when you are trying to ship a software with a framework that you don't know. So you mentioned Hilton. Is that like the hotel company?
Yeah, they have a pretty big in-house software shop, surprisingly.
I'd imagine so, yeah. What was that? What's that like? Because I imagine that's like heavily the type of area where if the software doesn't work, you're going to get a bunch of people who are angry that the software is not working.
Right.
So is that like a kind of a high-stakes environment working on booking software like that? Or is the booking software owned by Hilton themselves? Or is that like a third party? Or
yeah, so one of the pieces of software that I was on is the GME, the Groups, Meetings, and Events team. So one of the things that we supported is like, what if you could book more than 10 hotel rooms at a time? And as you can imagine, those transactions are just astronomical, right? Now, I didn't deal with the payment processing side myself, but even if there's a bug in that workflow that prevents you from moving forward, it's kind of like, oh, we just lost this incredibly large sale. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, big money.
So we made sure that, you know, we had our CI/CD systems in check as much as possible. We had an incredible QA team. In fact, we had dedicated accessibility teams for each of the groups that I was working within. So we really made sure that the standard of our software was very high.
Nice.
And what did you say what the stack was for that tech?
We were predominantly using React at the time.
Okay. Yeah, just checking out Hilton.com is Tailwind and React. It is Next.js.
Yeah, because I remember Next.js. I don't remember Tailwind as much, that may be a newer decision. You know, I haven't been there in a couple of years, so.
Oh, yeah. And with big companies like this, they often have, like, multiple applications, you know? Like, the booking, the thing that you worked on might not be the same app that does the, like, finding hotel rooms in Nashville. I'm just looking right now and filtering. Right, yeah, right. That's a wild world, the whole... Like booking an airplane.
Booking anything.
Or
dates, times, scheduling. I worked on a booking app and it sucked. It was so hard. And that was just a basic like scheduling app for hairdressers, you know? And that's like a whole decimal point or two difference in price tag compared to booking airplanes or booking hotel rooms or something like
right.
that.
one of the things that I was tasked with is actually building out the counters selection. And oh, I mean, lovely. you have to support 30 some odd brands because they support multiple of their brands. Oh. You have to support translations across a bunch of languages. Like there was a ton of functionality that went into the design system at Hilton.
Yeah, that's wild.
Maybe that should be a show is like, what are the, not the worst things, but like maybe like, what are the hardest things to work on? And I was talking to Scott. I was like, single sign-on is probably up there with like some of the worst things to work on. Because we use this thing that signs us out all the time of Notion. And then when you want to sign in, you got to click 18 things and
doesn't
bring
work
your
on my
firstborn.
Phone.
Yeah. I do not, even like with Air Canada, when I book a flight, man, it like you click on something and it like the URL bar changes like 16 times because it's like moving and checking things. And I do not envy people that have to work on that type of stuff. But all right, well, let's talk about what's the best framework. You know, you wrote this thing.
which one's the best? Yes. Hey, just tell us.
Let's just get this out of the way. Angular, Vue, or React.
Yeah, come on, Corbin. Why don't you have an answer for this? You wrote the book, right? Am I allowed to pull the "it depends" card? No, just yes. Pull that one out of the back pocket. So I have my personal preferences. You know, I really like what the Angular team has been doing. And I'm not just saying that because I went to ngConf. In fact, I went to ngConf on my own dime because I've been a fan of what they've been doing recently. So I'm a huge fan of Angular Signals and what they're doing with standalone components and stuff like that. Vue is absolutely up there. Their composition APIs have been kind of top of class for a long time. And it's only recently that things feel like they're starting to shake up. And then, of course, React is kind of like the golden child, you know, the one that everyone talks about and uses.
It's popular.
yeah, it's definitely popular. So I don't know. I really like Vue for a lot of like interactive websites, you know, like high interactivity, but also like not just interactivity, but event-driven UIs, right? Either that or utilizing RxJS's integrations with Angular is kind of my pick there. But especially if you're building static sites, I mean, not that necessarily you should be using any of these frameworks for a static site, but if you want to sprinkle interactivity throughout there, I think using something like Astro or Next.js with React is kind of a pretty big win there.
Yeah, totally. Awesome. So when you're diving into like comparisons, there's probably a lot of different sub areas of all of these frameworks to compare. How do you even think about the different sub areas of these things? And how do you compare things that might not be comparable between the two or three or four?
Great question. So when I was structuring the book, it was actually supposed to be one book originally. And I kept adding headings and like scaffolding out the like rough draft. And as I did this, I was like, there's like 50, 60 different headings in here. What am I going to do? So as I kept growing, I realized that there was a way that I could divide them into three separate books. The first one is the book that just came out called Fundamentals, Framework Field Guide Fundamentals, which just teaches the API of the frameworks themselves. No NPM install outside of the initial setup. No, you know, fetch or like needing an external server. Like you're just learning the absolute basics of the framework, right? The second book is Ecosystem. So like, you know, the meta frameworks, the Axioses, the routers, the, you know, whatever other libraries you might have. And then the third book will be Internals, which is rewriting React, Angular, and Vue from scratch and understanding exactly how they work under the hood. So that's been how I've been thinking about how to like structure the content. Is that like, like in order to learn, say, React Router or something like that, you kind of have to understand a little bit about how refs work, a little bit about how, you know, JSX like composes in different ways, how JSX is just a value, you know, so like, it really helps to have that foundation of knowledge, which is why I started there. The second challenge that you outlined there is, what do I do when there's a difference in each framework, right? Like Angular in particular has this concept of like view containers that you can then add a structural directive to, and it gets really like complex and messy, but it's important to know. So what I tend to do is in the book, there are three different tabs for all the three frameworks. And it allows you to switch between which of the frameworks you have. And usually there's like some basis of reference for the other frameworks. Like React doesn't really have the concept of directives, but you have a hook that you can return a ref from. So I try to do my best to kind of guide the user to be like, look, this isn't the same, but here's how I would do this in another framework.
Yeah.
And then if there's just no alternative, I will just be explicit and say, there's no alternative yet. You know, look at the other examples to get a guidance of what this might look like.
Yeah. Do you feel like the meta frameworks in these worlds are comparable? Because oftentimes, you know, on our end, we see a lot of Next.js on this show. We don't talk about Nuxt very often. And honestly, I don't even know what the meta framework in Angular world is like, if there is even one. Can you speak a little bit on that?
So the meta framework in Angular tends to be analog these days, built by Brandon Roberts.
Oh, we had him on the podcast.
Yeah. He does fantastic stuff. Analog just hit 1.0. So there's a lot of good stuff that's going on there. Then there's Nuxt, of course. And I think that Nuxt is pretty mature at this point. You know, there's a lot of, like, they have the Nuxt Studio, they have the Nuxt virtual stuff. So they're building a lot of really neat integrations. So I think that there is some good competition in the space of meta frameworks. And of course, there's even Astro, right? Like Astro doesn't really fit cleanly into those boxes, but they just released their database solution. So there's definitely more competition in the meta framework space than I think there used to be a couple of years ago.
So you just said you got back from ng-conf. How was that? Any interesting stuff announced there?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So first of all, it was one of my first few conferences. So, you know, there's always that hype and hubbub around any, you know, conference where you're able to get to meet folks. The big announcement was that YouTube is starting to use Angular signals, and they're trying to start merging in aspects of Angular and the internal Google framework Wiz together, which is really exciting to see, especially because Wiz has kind of like spawned some inspiration in Qwik, the other framework that's been released by the Angular creator.
Yep.
So it's definitely cool to see a lot of the announcement that have been going on there.
Yeah. Yeah, I was curious about that. So the combination there, because I saw a lot of people saying that Wiz and Angular are merging, but I don't necessarily think that's the case, right? Is it just that they're using aspects of Angular, like the signals within Wiz applications now over at Google?
So I talked to Minko about this, who's one of the Angular core members, and Jeremy as well, who's the technical lead at Angular. And what they were telling me at the conference is that, like, it's not necessarily that one is going away. It's more that they are learning resources from one another, right? So, like, Angular has been very interactive, dynamic, enterprisey, and Wiz has been much more static, like, extremely high-performance, low-latency environments, right? So we tend to think of these as opposite ends of the spectrum, but things like React Server components have really started to challenge that idea of, like, what if we had a really low latency, fast application that you could then add interactivity kind of like as you needed it. So I think what Angular team was telling me is that they're not necessarily merging, but they're learning from each other and developing out these similar technologies that they can use to kind of move back and forth between them internally.
Yeah, it always felt weird to me that there was a internal framework and an external framework, and, you know, depending on what project you were at, which one you used or whatever you used there. Mm-hmm. So that it only makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah, the Wiz is always interesting to me because, like, is Wiz even open source, or is it just like you've always just heard murmurs of what it is? The best way I've described it is, you know, like you search for, like, Google for, like, set a timer or color picker, and it just boom, it pops the color picker right in the Google results. That was always, like, wild to me. It's like, oh, how do they do that? And it's now that we have React Server components that can be, you can have client parts, I kind of understand that that's how they're doing it. So it's interesting to see that they are possibly going to be merging it as well, or not merging it. I know you said they're not merging it, but.
But still, that combination is still kind of, I don't know, it's kind of indicative of a merging of a kind.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Sarah Drasner's tweet says we're merging Angular and Wiz. So that's pretty clear to me, you know?
Huh. Yeah.
Yeah, it was definitely interesting because I think that there was a bit of a mismatched message between what was shown at ng-conf, like, conference stage, and what was mentioned in Twitter.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that tracks with what I saw.
Man, and does Vue have this idea, like let's talk about signals as well. Maybe can you give us a quick rundown of what signals are for anyone who hasn't heard of those before, and talk about, like, what does that look like in the different frameworks?
Sure. So signals are reactivity primitive, right? So let's kind of zoom out from what that means. Is that, like, let's say that we have a counter, right, on an application that's in HTML, right, in your DOM, in your browser, and then you have a bit of state that is in JavaScript that reflects that same count. And whenever you update the state in JavaScript, you want to reflect that state change in your browser in HTML. So what usually happens is that you might have like a query selector to the element, and then you'll like inner text update the value, something along those lines, right? But if I just mutate the value of count to say count equals 100, and I don't do anything to reflect that back to the DOM, there's a mismatch there, right, between what's in memory and what's in the DOM. So what people have tried to do is they've tried to figure out the solution about what does that look like to fix that, right? So signals are a way that you can have a method of updating a value in JavaScript that is then able to have listeners that are updated whenever the value state changes. In this case, that might be the DOM, or it might be an effect, something that runs whenever the state changes, just kind of implicitly by the value of the contract that's signed whenever you add a signal on top of a signal. So in Vue, that's very similar to ref, right? Which is their built-in state management in Vue. There's some differences internally in how they function, because you have things like proxies under the hood of Vue, and Angular doesn't really have that concept. And there's different performance heuristics there, but ultimately they are very similar concepts in that you have a computed value in Vue, you have a ref that you update, and the computed will automatically rerun. React, on the other hand, has much more of a manual reactivity system, where if you want to update a value, you'll use useState or useReducer or something like that. And when you update a value, you are explicitly telling it, hey, I want to go rerun anything that is inside of this function or within the listeners of that function. I'm using listeners there for React as more of a loose term, because React doesn't really have a primitive of state that works outside of the framework. Instead, it uses the renderer to track the reactivity much more than anything.
Yeah, that's one thing that I've always found frustrating with React, is that I kind of do want something that's outside of React for managing my state. And I know, like, there's pre-act signals, there's lots of libraries that will do it, but I kind of wish that there was like we just built the syntax website in Svelte. And the fact that you could just import state into the component that you want it and update it where you want it, and not have to do this whole song and dance of passing it down or putting it in context and making it available in the air and grabbing it out of the air. I find that very refreshing. And I understand the benefits of that type of thing, because it's you have to explicitly pass it in if you want it. But when I've tried either like stores that we have in Svelte or like preact signals you can use in vanilla JavaScript. So cool. I absolutely love it. So I'm really hoping that we see one day we'll see that in React world, and B, there's talk of adding signals to vanilla JavaScript. There's talk of adding it to the browsers, which is pretty cool. Right, do you have any thoughts on if that's a good idea or not?
You know, it's always a cost trade-off, the initial download of the browser versus the subsequent downloads of each web page, right? And then there's a challenge of standardization, right? The way that signals work in, say, Angular, where you have a push-pull hot-cold system with the reactivity, versus, say, like I'm on the TanStack team, we built out our own signals implementation called TanStack Store. There's just a world of difference between how those two function, and they have different rationales behind them, and it makes sense, right? So it's definitely very interesting to see how we will standardize, but it'll also be a very powerful tool. So I mentioned I'm on the TanStack team. One of the projects I'm leading is TanStack Form. And one of the things that we're able to do, because signals are runtime agnostic, you can run them in Node or you can run them in the browser, is we can have our like primitives, our reactive primitives, just work whether you're server-side rendering on the server or on the client. So we can do isomorphic form handling and validation, and that we get that basically for free. Like, I didn't intentionally build it out that way, but it works perfectly as if we had built it intentionally that way, just because all of our primitives were runtime agnostic.
Yeah. It's interesting that I know that it's going to be baked in the next version of Svelte, signal-based state. So it does really feel like a convergence on that idea, which I do like. And specifically, if it ever does get implemented browser, I'm sure in the browser in JavaScript, I'm sure there will still be these wrappers around them in terms of like how that proxying works or what special juice they all have. But it is really, I don't know, it's really, really inspiring to see so many people converge around this and take different approaches. And everybody's kind of in the same mind that it works really well. And Wes, if you like state in Svelte now, you're going to like it in the next release, because that signal-based state is really great to work in. So I just can't wait for that to come.
Yeah, I'm pretty stoked about that. I was seeing, and we have a Slack room that the Svelte team at Sentry was asking the folks at Vercel, hey, when is Svelte 5 coming out? They dropped a couple, because Sentry wants to make sure that day zero that everything works with Svelte. So if you want to upgrade on the first day, everything's going to work perfectly. So they're trying to make sure that everything's ready for when that goes. So coming soon. I can't say when, but I'm pretty excited about it.
And I do want to say to pump my own tires here too. I have a little bit of an inside track there, and I got the scoop. I want to have a course out like the day it's dropped too. I don't know if I'll be able to hit that, but check on the Syntax YouTube channel for that, because who knows, right?
Let's talk about something similar to signals, and that is this concept of derived state. I think this is kind of interesting as well, because there's all these like words that get thrown out, and I think a lot of people listening are saying, I don't know what a signal is, and you just did an awesome explanation. So like, can you also tell us what a derived state or computed state is and how that varies in different frameworks?
Yeah. So if we think about state as a value that is stored, right, that you are able to update, there's also this bit of value in creating a primitive that is able to take that initial state and change it in some form, right? So like the most basic example might be a count and then a double of that count. Right. You don't necessarily care about updating that double count manually, because you want it to automatically be based off of that initial count. A more complex example might be like, man, I'm really struggling to think of a cart. Example.
You have items in your cart.
Mm-hmm. So what is the total cost of all the value items in that cart? Thank you, Wes. So, you know, these ideas that you have a reactive primitive, right, allows you to kind of piggyback off that idea and say, well, what if we use an effect, but instead of the effect being rendering to a template like the DOM, we have that effect be another bit of state that is derived from the initial bit of state. So in Angular's new signals implementation, that's computed. So the same in Vue, and then in React, it's more of a use memo type deal, which is kind of different because it deals with memoization, but I'm going to extend a bridge and say they're the same. And then, of course, in Svelte, I know that they likely have some similar story with runes, like you guys were mentioning with Svelte 5. So it's definitely very cool to have that reactive primitive be able to power more than just, cool, we're updating the DOM. Well, it's now we're updating the DOM and other state and other items that then rely on that state as well.
Totally.
And I guess one thing we didn't mention before we hit signals is like state management. Let's run through that as well. Like what are the different ways to store state in these different frameworks?
Mm-hmm. So if we think about it, there are like each of these frameworks shares one big thing in common, right? They're component based. They allow for composition. Right. So you might have the shopping cart, which the button of the shopping cart, which is in the header, which is in the application. Right. So what you could do is you could have a global store that says something like, hey, I want to provide the shopping cart data to the entire application and have it go from there. Or you might have something that says like, we have the shopping cart button, and that shopping cart button only has the bit of state that contains the amount of data for the just the button itself. There's a couple of different ways that you can, you know, you can go one extreme where you're like super localized, your data is just stored within one area. You can go super global where there's another aspect. You can kind of go in between and use dependency injection to provide values using like context or provide an inject so that you can access the values between two different components. You can prop pass. Like the power of a lot of these frameworks is that they have guardrails for sure, but they have a lot of flexibility with how you provide data throughout your application, depending on your needs.
Yeah. What about like passing children? You know, React has a concept of passing children. The new Svelte version is quite a bit different, but can you speak a little bit about like what the way to do that is in different frameworks, whether it's slots or whatever, and how that works.
You stole one of the keywords from me.
I know.
I'm going to mention the slots. No, it's a good highlight though, right? So when we build out a bit of templating just in HTML, like ignoring the frameworks for a second, you might have an unordered list, a list item, a span, and then some text nodes, right? So when you're doing that, you're building a tree of structure, right? So you have your root node, which is your unordered list, and then you have your children nodes and your grandchildren and whatever else, right? You can do the same with your components. You can have the header that has a slot or a child injection area, which allows you to then have your button that then has an icon, which then has, you know, so on and so forth, right? And that was the power that I was talking about earlier with these components being able to compose one another. So not only you have your DOM tree, you also have your component tree, and your component tree may match one-to-one with your DOM tree, but then there's even concepts like portals that allow you to jump an item from one part of your component tree out to a separate part of your HTML tree. So there's a lot of power that we have to be able to control how we scaffold and compose our components.
Oh, that's cool. And who's got the best, like your personal opinion on passing these types of things, right? Because with React, it's just children. And if you want to specifically name them and pass them in, then you are going from kind of the nice syntax of like literally passing as a child, then you just got to pass it as a prop. And that can get a little bit hairy if that prop also needs children, and all of a sudden you're rendering inside of a prop can get a little bit funky. What do you think? What's the best implementation of this?
So two of my particular favorites, because I tend to stay away from best versus worst just because I think it's all subjective, right?
I'm trying to get it out of you.
I know you are, but
I'm going to remove a question that I have for you here.
Okay. So in my opinion, I really like the way that both React's JSX does it. And this is not specific to React. Solid does this. Vue can do it depending on how you use it. But JSX allows you to pass literal values as children. So for example, in some of the libraries I maintain, we use that ability to pass a function. And that function, you can then pass properties to it. You can do really wild things with JSX. Like you can pass an add component, just a number as a child, and it'll literally display the addition of one number and a separate number that you pass in children, which is super strange to think of. Like instead of this component tree, it's a tree of values. So it really requires a shift in thought to make an API like that work cognitively. But then there's also like Angular's structural directives, which are really, really powerful. This ability to like dynamically load in data and then unload data and control like how you inject templates into another place. Like you have a lot of power there, even if the learning curve is really high in Angular.
All right. I got a really good question for you, and it's about the TanStack stuff. So you said do you work for, or you're a maintainer on the TanStack stuff?
Yeah, I'm lead maintainer of the form. And then I also maintain config and store as well.
Awesome. So part of the reason that I love the TanStack stuff is he sort of has peeled it back from initially a lot of it was like React stuff. And now he's peeled it back and said it's just JavaScript frameworks and that it works with all of these different frameworks. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's ideal because we've got all these different frameworks. And if somebody, like you guys are smart, you're building this stuff, it would be a shame to have to like rebuild that for all of the other frameworks. So I'm just curious, like what's the approach to build something that can work in all of these different frameworks?
Yeah. So there's a secret sauce there, and it's TanStack Store, right? It kind of depends. Some of the other frameworks aren't using Store yet, but we're refactoring them slowly to use it. But okay. If you see a framework agnostic library, they're using something like this, where in order to control your own reactivity, you have to own a reactivity primitive, whether that's a signal, whether that's an observable, some kind of data mechanism that is able to inform the framework when to re-render, which is really backwards from application building, right? In an application, you have state in your app that tells the framework when to re-render. Instead, we have state outside of the framework and even outside of the application sometimes that then tells the framework when to re-render, which is really peculiar to think about when you're building something like this. So we have TanStack-Store, which is our own framework agnostic signals implementation. And then we have useStore in like a ton of different frameworks, just a bunch of them. And then for each framework library that we build, you know, Angular forms or Preact forms or whatever, we then use the core API, which we've built in plain vanilla JavaScript, works with reactivity outside of a framework. And then we glue it back into the reactivity of each specific framework.
Oh, that's yeah. wild. I've always that's wondered glue, that. I'm yeah. like, what's the actual, how come you can build this stuff so low level and have it work in all of them? And like, how much of it is framework specific, you know, like
yeah, how much of it is
90% vanilla and 10% React, or like at what point is the adapter? And I'll ask that question first, and I have another follow up.
I'd say it's closer to 95% vanilla, 5% wow. adapter. Like cool. I think, especially with the TypeScript types, like we have a couple hundred lines of TypeScript types for form. And then yeah. we just have the same utility types that we then export and reuse in each adapter. When we yeah. wrote the Angular adapter, the biggest question was like, what API do we want it to have for each framework, mm-hmm. right? And I think that that's the more cognitively challenging piece, is that each of these frameworks have different capabilities. So what do we want it to look like and keep the look and feel of the base API very similar to one another? But yeah, I'd say it's like, you know, a couple hundred lines of code in vanilla, maybe 100-ish. Even lines in framework. So it's definitely 90, 95 to 10 to 5%.
And most of these things, if not all of them, are headless. Because I was going to ask, like, does it mm-hmm. do all the tracking of the DOM stuff as well? But it's not DOM based, right? It's all headless.
So we could have built our APIs. There's nothing unique about going from framework agnostic to DOM APIs. Like, we could have built a fully headed solution, or like a, what was the joke that Tanner and I were making recently? The leaded solution, right? of having the framework built into the DOM APIs and then having like gluing code there.
Yeah.
The reason why we don't want to get into that territory often is that it kind of constrains what you can build. Right? Like, TanStack Form works perfectly in native script or in React mm. Native or even in Next.js because there's no DOM APIs. Mm-hmm. And moreover, what happens when someone wants to use a custom UI framework, or they want yep. to use a logger to keep track of their forms that they have like an SDK for, right? So there's a lot there that's kind of like, you know, we don't want to limit the usage of our libraries in applications.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And do you have any like best practices for writing this type of thing? Because we hear all the time from people saying, all right, well, like my company is redoing all of its UI components, and we've got two Angular apps, we got three React apps, and we got something mm-hmm. built in jQuery, and we need this to work absolutely everywhere. And like the TanStack mm-hmm. stuff is a really good example of how you can reuse it across the board. Do you have any best practices for writing that type of thing?
Yeah. So my first piece of advice is really weird and probably unpopular. It's don't do it. Like kind of unironically, the more code you have, the more likely you are to introduce bugs, the more you have to maintain. And especially when you make like divergent tech stack decision making, the complexity in building this stuff just ramps up to 100. Right. So my first advice would be, please don't do it for your own sake. Yeah. But let's put that aside. And it's like, okay, we're megacorp. We're going to have to use three frameworks because, you know, we have different reasons and we have different needs and whatever else. Right. I would say the first thing is try to find, I think a lot of this actually starts with design and project management. Right. I was talking with the Progress folks at ngConf about this, and a bit of it is like, how do we get designers to get in a room together and agree that we don't need 18 shades of a purple on a button, right?
Yeah.
Or how do we get PMs to agree that our date pickers should work consistently with one another, and that their application really doesn't need, say, support for like supporting two date ranges and only one date range. You know what I mean? Like how do we get the consolidation from that aspect and grow from there from a technical standpoint? So I think to start at the decision-making process is kind of crucial. From there, you have a lot of decisions. You can use something like web components to be able to build a framework agnostic, you know, UI component layer. You can do, and there's even integrations like Lit Labs that allow you to kind of glue that back into your framework a little bit more easily. You have, what is it called? It's from Builder.io, Mitosis, that allows you to build out one template that then compiles to multiple different frameworks. So yeah, there's a lot of different technical solutions once you have that base business decision-making to go off of.
Yeah. Well, since you probably have to test in all kinds of frameworks, and I know you're, you know, the framework field guide guy, there has to be something in one of the frameworks that irks you more than anything else in any of the other frameworks. Is there a pain point that you've hit where you're just like, why, comparatively?
Yeah. So the one that I have, Vue, please work on your directives. They are so limited in what they can do. Like, I want to be able to build like conditional UI using your directives, and the API for directives isn't very easy to make type safe, and it's, I don't know, it's like a bit of a sore spot, because I love directives as you know, a past Angular developer and even like current Angular lover, right? Like components are directives, and that's just not the case in Vue, or at least it doesn't feel that way in terms of their APIs.
Word. Oh, I had to rephrase that question to get you to answer it.
And is there any implementation of anything where it's like three times the code in one of the languages and you think, ah, come on, couldn't there be a better way to do this?
I mean, not really. Like, I found that there, like, you know, each framework has different lengths and shortenings and whatnot. Yeah. But I don't find that any of them have like so much more boilerplate that it's overwhelming. The only exception that I can think of that is maybe Angular's CLI. Their CLI is really powerful in ways that I think Vue has kind of like hidden away. Mm-hmm. And even then, Angular is starting to move towards Vue. So this problem gets solved eventually. But I think that like if the minute you open the angular.json file, you're like, whoa, there's a lot here. But in terms of actual code that you write, I don't find that there's like a particular like boilerplate headache there.
Yeah. Not even like forms in React, like binding a variable to an input in React. Or that's the other thing with React, is like often you are just a little bit more primitive in React, and you're expected to install something or bring your own helper library around. And forms are changing now that we're getting React server components.
Mm-hmm. You know, I guess so to answer your question, there are headaches, right? Now that I'm thinking about them. But the reason why they don't come to mind initially is that they tend to be like signs of malpractice, right? Like when you have a state that has hundreds of components for your form, probably doing something wrong, right? Maybe we should be reaching for a better abstraction or a better tool, whether it's in-house or out-house, right? So there's a lot to consider there in terms of like, if you are running into a ton of boilerplate, I'm usually not super dry. Like I tend to prefer copying and pasting once or twice before we find a good abstraction to sit on.
Yeah.
But if you are copying and pasting too much, it's usually a good sign that we should find an abstraction or maybe a different pattern to leverage.
By the way, outhouse.js is not taken on NPM. I think that'd be awesome, an awesome library for like outhouse.js really helps you bring out abstract your form state across multiple renderers, something like that.
Yeah, that'll be the next Tansack project. Tansack outhouse.
Yes, absolutely. what about web components here? We briefly mentioned them as being like an agnostic UI layer. Do you have any thoughts on how web components fit into all of this?
Sure. I think web components are really good for like base primitives, you know, buttons or text inputs or something like that. I think they tend to struggle in terms of larger applications or even a lot more complex parts of the UI. You know, there's no primitive for portals, right? Mm-hmm. There's no base primitive for portals. There's no base primitive for XYZ. So especially with web components, it really is very heavily a bring your own tooling solution. You know, there's Lit, there used to be Polymer, which that, you know, kind of absorbed. But you're running into the other headache of developer experience, right? Like a lot of people mm-hmm. just tend to prefer or know the other tooling, and they tend to have a lot nicer, you know, DX stories around them. So it's interesting to see how web components can fit in an organization, but also acknowledging that they tend to lack some of the power developer experience that other tools use.
Yeah.
Let's talk about actually writing this book. So first of all, we probably should have mentioned this off the top of the show. It's free. Right? Like,
yeah.
How come it's free? And you do this hilarious thing where it's just like, you have a pricing table, but it's just as free on all of the options. What's the idea behind that? Do you not like money?
Yeah, I joke with my friends often that I'm allergic to money, and I'm an open source money? Maintainer. Yeah. And I wrote a free book. The actual answer is that I grew up in a household where, you know, we struggled in a lot of different ways. You know, not as much as others, but you know, we had to get food stamps occasionally. We had to pick between the cereal and the milk, and even now the finances that I have been transformative to my family's life and to my life, in ways that are sometimes very private, sometimes very public. And I love working in the industry, right? I joke with my friends that I would have been fired as a line cook years ago just because I lack the hand-eye coordination and the time management. And, you know, like, I just don't have the skills to do anything outside of programming, right?
Yeah.
So to be in this industry is huge for me. You know, I dropped out of high school, so I don't have the education on my side. There's just a lot of fighting against you going into the industry as someone with my background, right? And I want to be able to help reduce that friction as much as possible for others. You know, now that I've made it in, how can I swing that door as open wide and as frequently for others as I can? So that was the rationale behind the books being free. I want to help others get into the industry. I want to help them transform their lives and help, you know, in any way that I can.
Nice. That, like Wes mentioned, that the pricing thing is very funny. But I think he even understated how funny it is. I mean, you have that for enterprise toggle, and it fades in text that says absolutely nothing changes, still free, tax included on the zero, tax not included on the $0. I mean, this is hilarious. If you're out there, great. This is great site inspiration too. If you're looking for some site inspiration, did you design this yourself?
No. I lack the pen and paper design skills as well. Shout out to Ed Pratty for doing the website design, and shout out to Kevin Aguilar for doing the illustration design. For real, they both did incredible work.
Yeah, it's sick. The whole site is great. Yeah, feels smooth. Nice. Looks great. Yeah, super pro. Yeah.
Yeah. The color transitions took a while. If you scroll down from one part of the page to the other, it just changes the whole page to one color or another. That was a really close collaboration between Ed Pratty and I.
Yeah, that's gorgeous. Yeah.
I'm a big fan of that. It's a very fun website just to scroll. Big fan of that. And what's the process of writing a book like this? So like, I wrote a book probably 10 years ago that I published online as well, but it's been a long time. What's your process of that? And what's your tech stack of actually getting this thing published?
Yeah. In fact, I think our tech stack is interesting, but I'll answer the first question first.
Yeah.
So when I structured the book in my mind, I was like, look, I know what I want to teach, right? I want to be able to teach people enough to get an application up and running, and then be able to like sprinkle in enough that they can start contributing to open source. They can start understanding the internals, improving their performance. So what I did is I had a couple of paragraphs written, and what I would do is I would write a paragraph and I'd go, that reminds me, I've got to write about this. And I'd add a heading, and then I'd write a couple of to-do comments. And eventually I did this. And as I mentioned, I ran into 60 different headings. And I realized, oh dear, this is going to be quite the problem. So from there, what I did is I thought, okay, well, how can I group these headings together, right? Maybe not necessarily as a single chapter, but if I do have to make these individual chapters, what is the linear and cognitive flow that a user will go through as they're reading through the book and learning, right? So my books make some weird decisions. It teaches use effect before it teaches use state. Mm-hmm. Who does that, right? That's a really weird decision. Or it teaches use ref really early on. It teaches use effect like frequently as opposed to, you know, avoiding it like other like people have been suggesting recently.
Yeah.
So the idea there is that I wanted to start with, I never wanted to introduce an API I couldn't explain with another API. And I never wanted to introduce an API that I hadn't shown at all before. Like there are two instances in the book and they both like are daggers in my heart that I had to do it just because I couldn't think of an alternative. So I try to keep my book as close to a linear thought process and flow as you can.
Yeah, I hadn't considered doing the use effect before use state because it does feel like use state is such a, you know, you get some stuff on the screen, whatever. But it all makes sense when you think about, hey, all of these things render in very different ways. The rendering cycle is important, especially in React. So understanding how use effect plays into that seems like a big deal to hit early. So yeah, that's cool. That's an interesting idea.
I think about that a lot as well, is how do you teach something which is not linear, which is programming. It's just scatterbrain, run around, your hair caught on fire, learning different things here or there for years. And like, how do you convert that to something that is linear, which is here's one thing, here's the next thing, here's the next thing, when sometimes you need one thing before, like it's circular in some cases. So yeah, definitely appreciate that a lot of work goes into thinking about that type of thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what's the tech stack for writing and publishing this whole thing, right? Like it's not a physical book, right? Like it's something that you can read online.
So yes, today, but there will be a physical edition sometime in the near future. I just need to pony up the money to make it happen.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh yeah. I've actually seen some Amazon's print on demand. Have you looked into that at all?
There's been a few options.
Expensive, but good quality.
Yeah, big time.
Yeah, you should reach out to Joel Hooks if you haven't, because I know he's been getting quite a bit into that area with Sarah Drasner's book, and yeah
absolutely. So the tech stack we went with was Markdown, just plain simple Markdown, no MDX, no nothing else. But then there's a question of, wait, there's tabs and there's interactivity in the book, how did you do that with Markdown?
Yeah,
and this is where my answer goes from like really simple to why did you do this. So in order to get both a publishing pipeline that can export to an EPUB or a PDF or physical book or interactive website, what we did is we wrote custom compiler markdown compiler plugins for Rehype and Remark that then take custom syntax, which are made in HTML comments, and transforms them in pretty major ways depending on what output you're looking to do. So our toolchain is all custom right now that allows you to export to multiple different formats. But in the near future, I'm hoping to open source that as a write your own book in Markdown, have it interactive, have everything else run just right out of the box. So we're planning on documenting this in a much more in-depth solution.
Man, for those of you out there who haven't done this custom Markdown renderer stuff, there's a lot you can do there. I for the Level Up tutorial site, I did kind of something similar to like what MDN has, where they're trying to show the CSS, different CSS tabs, and you click apply to different CSS and then you have the renderer in there. And you can do all that with just, you have like a little key or something that the renderer can pick up on, and then you can do all sorts of stuff with that. It's really super powerful.
Yeah, it's that whole Rehype world is so powerful, so frustrating, but like when it starts working, feels so good, you know? Totally. You pretty much had to build your built your own programming language, I guess, for the tabs, you know? It needs a whole syntax and wild, wild world.
Yeah. And then, you know, for the interactive website, we used Astro, and all the interactivity that you see on the site, with the exception of the search page, all the interactivity has no framework, no nothing like that. It's just vanilla JavaScript that we add in to sprinkle interactivity throughout the site.
Love it.
Let's jump into some Supper Club questions. These are a set of questions we ask everybody who comes on the show. The first one we have here is, what text editor, theme, and font are you using?
So I use WebStorm and a material, I think it's Pale Night theme. So it's this like nice dark shade of purple that I have. And then for font, I've always been a Fira code user with ligatures enabled.
Yeah, I like ligatures myself, yeah.
I can't believe you're a WebStorm user and you went 52 minutes without telling us that you're a WebStorm user. That's probably probably
it's
like
a record.
A record for somebody that uses the JetBrains product. So congrats.
That's very funny. Yeah. super funny.
I was say I have like an ongoing thing is like anytime there's this one guy went and like this is not even on purpose, but he went on one of my TikToks and commented on, I'm not lying, 10 comments saying WebStorm does this, WebStorm does this, WebStorm does this. Cause like I can't post anything about VS Code without the WebStorm folks coming out being like, you're doing it wrong. The NeoVim folks, really cool, but there's some WebStorm folks out there.
Although, Wes, the NeoVim folks are getting a little rowdy. We had a lot of comments on CJ's getting started video with the VS Code setup, and there's like, not using Vim, opinion disregarded. cool. Awesome. Wow, you're very cool. Okay, what terminal and shell do you use?
So I'm one of those weirdos that uses multiple different operating systems. So on Windows, it's a Windows terminal. And then on Mac, it's iTerm 2, even though I think it's version 3, which I found a little confusing.
iTerm 2 version 3, yeah.
Yeah. And then I believe on Linux, last time I used it, which is that long ago, I was using the elementary terminal.
Sick.
Next one. How do you stay up to date? I'm specifically curious about that because you know a lot about lots of frameworks, which is wild to me.
Yeah, mostly Twitter, if I'm being honest. I use the mute and block buttons aggressively, even when I don't actually dislike the person. like I have a lot of people who I think are authentically wonderful people that just post too much stuff that's not really related to tech. So I'm like, okay, well, I wish you the best. Be muted. You know, but you know, it's funny because I have a personal account where I just go follow all those same people, just not on my main account. And it's because I use, you know, I used to have like real troubles focusing with like social media and stuff. And nowadays I have it very, very narrowly focused on just like tech news and tech updates. So that's how I'm able to stay up to date mostly is that I found that and watching and starting a bunch of GitHub issues. GitHub's homepage is one of my favorite features that everyone hates. It's the ability to see all the new stuff that's coming up on GitHub. I adore, but most people are like, why is it there? I don't understand. But like, it's such an underutilized resource.
I find all kinds of stuff from there. Or what's really great is if you follow a bunch of really smart people, library authors, people like Jared Palmer, like those types of people are starring a lot of repos that are maybe like very interesting, but nobody knows. Or like AntFu, great follow. You follow those types of people, and then whenever they star a repo, it just pops into your little feed, and you're like, oh, what are these people looking at?
Yeah, starring issues also, like following issues is really good. Like I got tagged in a React issue about I was like posing a bunch of questions about like why is use form state and use form action, like why are those two separate things, and I didn't totally understand it, and they're revising that API, so they had tagged me in it and said like thanks for the feedback, and like man, reading through that issue about like all the like, why is this an issue? Why is it like this way? What does the API design look like? I'm like, I feel smarter just reading this thing, you know? And
yeah,
there's so many smart people going back and forth on these issue threads that you might be missing. So that's a good tip of just finding good ones.
And the big one is the RFCs. Like I swear I have major frameworks RFCs just pinned to a second monitor at all time. And just auto-refreshing every 5 minutes. Because as soon as they show up, I mean, you just have the galaxy brains of the universe popping up into those threads and just like spewing the smartest things that I would never think of. And I'm just like, I'm here for it. I'm ready to read.
Yeah, and it gets you a good handle on what could be coming down the pipeline, especially like for people like, you know, the three of us who would probably want to know about these things earlier rather than later. You can know what they're thinking.
I think everybody should read the RFCs because
many
people are so whiny once an API has gone through 4 years of back and forth. It's like, where were you for 4 years if you care this much?
You had
about
a chance.
It?
Yeah, you know? You had a chance.
Oh, that's great. Last question we have here is a piece of advice for beginners. Specifically, you said you dropped out of high school, so I'm curious as to like, any advice you have for someone who may be in a similar situation?
Yeah. My two biggest pieces of advice, just get started and be bold. you know, there's something to be said about, you know, being respectful, of course, right? Like, don't go outside and just like start bullying people or thinking you're the smartest thing on earth. But there is a bit of, you know, you don't have to have a big name to walk in the room. You don't have to have the most stars on GitHub to come talk to people or even shoot a DM, right? You know, come ask us questions, come converse with us, especially, you know, like as content creators, I think we can all agree that having positive feedback is just awesome, right? Like, we get so many hate comments of like, well, oh, yeah, you're an idiot, you've never been in the industry and blah, blah, like, yeah, like, which is just not true, right? There's just an objective falsehood there.
They're just insecure.
Yeah. But coming by and saying, hey, I don't understand X, Y, or Z, great video, whatever, is a great way to have a content creator even directly address what you're trying to say. Is like, hey, you know, it is this way because the React team, blah, 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 right? That's super insightful comments that you might not be able to understand if you're getting it new into the industry and looking kind of in random places. Community is another big part of that, right? If you can find a strong community that's supportive of you, stay in it and ask as many questions as you can. But then, yeah, just getting started. You know, I think we have our own inhibitions and it prevents us from moving forward. And the minute you take that first step forward and keep walking, eventually you'll end up writing a book. That's how I found it anyways.
Nice.
Love that.
Okay, well, let's get into sick picks and shameless plugs. Do you have a sick pick for us today?
I sure do. Yeah. So my sick pick would probably be Shiki, the syntax highlighter. It's been working on for a long time, kind of stewing in the oven. And finally, they just released a version one and it's really good. It supports all the languages and plugins and any other features you could ever want.
It's really nice. Cool. Especially the ability to provide your own elements for whatever it is you want. And you can add in, like, I was looking at it specifically on how to add like type hinting into my code examples. And like, it's super powerful and it works really well.
Yeah. And that little demo is pretty convincing right there at the homepage. So very into that.
Yeah, it looks great. I need to get my Cobalt 2 theme in here as a list of possible ones. Cause
there you go.
The problem is I published my Cobalt 2 theme as like a JSON with comments, so you can't just npm install it and require it because it's comments in it. So I need to switch that out somehow, or like compile it to a JSON without comments. Mm-hmm. What about shameless plugs? What would you like to plug away? As many things as you like.
Please come read the framework field guide. I spent 2 years writing it and updating the website that is published on, all that good stuff. We have a community called Unicorn Utterances. So if you go to unicorn-utterances.com, we have a Discord community where we love to help newcomers out. We're always looking for either new contributors or just people to come join us and hang out and ask questions. So we're happy to help however we can, whether you're reading the book or not.
Sick. Cool. Well, it's been a blast to have you on here. It's definitely got a lot out of this, all frameworks included, and just in general, man, you've been working on a lot of cool stuff. So
yeah,
thank you so
great.
Much for coming on, Corbin.
Yeah, thank you both. Really appreciate it.
Cool. All right. We will check you later.
Peace.
Peace. Bye.